Welcome to Between the Rows, where you get to hear the stories behind the stories in Canada's leading farm publications.
Hello, and welcome to Between the Rows, the podcast of Glacier Farm Media. I'm your host this week, Gord Gilmore. On this episode, we'll be delving into a controversial attack ad released by one Ontario farm group. Ed White of the Western Producer speaks to the Federal Agriculture Minister, Marie-Claude Bibeau, and two reporters give us their take on the reality of mid-sized meat packers and why there aren't any. Phil Franz Workington of Markets Farm will also update us on commodity markets. The Grain Farmers of Ontario kicked off some controversy recently with an advertisement that some say was wide of the mark and others say was a needed dose of straight talk. We'll let you be the judge.
You've already seen the empty shelves. The food supply chain is breaking. This isn't happening someplace far away, but right here at home. Everyone needs a helping hand today, and family farms are no different. Today, farmers are being asked to shoulder immense risk. It takes millions of dollars to put crops in the ground, but prices are unstable and collapsing. Why should farmers shoulder that risk alone? Even Donald Trump knows that farmers need help. He's helping his farmers with $19 billion in relief programs. Trudeau has been asking farmers to go more and more into debt since the pandemic started, even cruelly increasing taxes right when farmers are about to plant. While Trump looks out for his farmers and his country's food supply, Trudeau is standing by as Canada's farms and food supply collapse. When the farms and farmers are gone, where are we going to get our food from? Visit grainfarmers.ca, a message from the Grain Farmers of Ontario.
That was the audio of a controversial attack ad that was just released by the Grain Farmers of Ontario. We're joined now by Farmtario editor John Gregg, who's written on this topic. John, thanks for joining us today.
No problem, Gordon.
So that's a pretty pointed ad, and it was probably destined to be right from the start controversial. What's the reaction been in the Ontario agriculture sector?
So I'd say there's been a very mixed reaction. So there are some farmers, grain farmers mostly, who say, yes, it's about time we hit back at the government that's not supporting us. There's reasons they're at this point, and not a lot of them are COVID related particularly. It's been a long time since grain farmers had a policy funding win. There were some good years in grain farming. The last two or three years, especially in corn and soybeans, have been challenging, especially with some of the Trump policies and the way those have hit the price and supply of corn and soybeans. And the programs that exist in Canada seem capable of helping. If you take the agri-stability program, for example, it's 10% greater loss now than it used to trigger that program. So there's lots of frustration. And then when you've had the COVID-19 programs, it just added to that sense of frustration for crop farmers. So However, there's been certainly a very strong reaction from other farmers too, that, you know, they say, well, yeah, we understand it's tough for grain farmers, but there's been some significant dismay and unhappiness from other farmers. And if you look at the some of the Facebook post comments to the ad, you know, from where the grain farmers have promoted it on Facebook, there's not a lot of support there either. A bit of support, but not a lot of it.
So what can you tell us about the comments that have come in from people who are concerned about it? What are their worries?
Well, there's several points here, and as you said, it was probably destined to be controversial right start. The first is the tone. You know, it's a very it's ominous and pretty focused on grain farmers, and you need to help us now. And generally, these days, as somebody in another person in agriculture leadership mentioned to me, is that, you know, we want to be number two. We want to be behind the medical workers and the frontline workers. We don't necessarily want to be seen as trying to push ourselves ahead of them, and there's no mention of them in this ad. And then, you know, most Canadians are going to see declines in their net incomes this year, and many are going to lose their jobs. So, and still put a crop in the ground, might not be a very good year, and it was going to be a tough year in grain farming anyway, but a lot of Canadians are in the same boat. Another point is that for the past 10 or 20 years, farmers have told consumers, you know, don't believe fear-based marketing about food on GMOs, on pesticides, on meat. Look to the science, look to what the truth is. And, you know, this is very much a fear-based, the tradition of a fear-based marketing campaign. And then, you know, for example, there's very, you know, there's a few things that are in short supply in the grocery stores, but they, you know, the ad claims that the food system is breaking and the shelves are empty, which people aren't really finding in the grocery stores. So another point is the idea that this is probably aimed at farmers, not necessarily at consumers. Something that agriculture had been moving away from in the past, hadn't done a great job in the marketing of really getting to urban consumers compared to creating something that actually would just play well with their farm constituents. And this is certainly plays well to not happiers, but you know, there's just points where the you know, for example, the claim that the American government has better managed the food supply, better than the Canadian government, that's not the general perception out there. For grain farmers who haven't got a big check like the American grain farmers, that might be the perception, but certainly not the perception among the general public. And there's just the concern about how the images in the ad portray farmers. There's a ramshackle barn, there's an image that's almost certainly European, and then the other images aren't really what the reality of what people are finding in their grocery stores. So there's just, yeah, there's several, you know, kind of very structural and technical issues that are causing quite a bit of concern.
So is the big risk then sort of alienating the Canadian public? What are the risks you see with this approach?
Yeah, I think that's the big concern, is that there's been a lot of work done to maintain that public trust, the public license, they call it, to produce food. And now the concern is that that this may break down some of that. Sure, we know that attack ads work. It's certainly been proved in Canada, the United States, and everywhere else in the world, especially during election campaigns. But we're really not in an election campaign. We're in a, you know, for the biggest global health crisis of 100 years. So there's concern that there's a danger that consumers seeing people putting out attack ads in this time period will end up with some backlash. And then the other danger for grain farmers is a lot of these issues are not COVID-19 related. They're structural issues in the grain market. There's a general oversupply. We're just in a down cycle in the grain market. The Trump administration's kind of his a lot of their policies have been very challenging for farmers, and have really had a serious effect on grain farmers. And if you tie all that to, and then there's a problem with our safety nets here aren't really working for grain farmers. If you tie all that to COVID-19, then what happens the next time farmers need some help? When you come to the government and say, hey, we need some help, it's like, oh, well, I thought that was all COVID-19, we gave you some money then, right? So, and then as somebody said to me that, you know, the point is that, so that a lot of farmers bring up the fact that students got a bunch of money because they're not gonna be able to find work for this summer. So then when farmers ask for money in a future non-pandemic time, can the students go, hey, we need some money too? So I think there's some concern about tying non-COVID related issues to COVID-19. Certainly ethanol, decline in ethanol demand and its effect on corn price is a COVID related effect. But compared to some of the others, it's grain farmers haven't had quite the same issue.
And that actually is an interesting point in and of itself. I was a little surprised to see this coming from grain farmers. As you alluded to a bit earlier, they haven't been particularly hard hit relative to some of the other agriculture sectors. And some of the problems, as you noted, are structural problems that vastly predate COVID-19. So was it a surprise to see the grain farmers taking this hard stance?
So two things on that. This is the COVID-19 issue and the fact that there are some supply chain problems related to COVID effect on corn price. And it's kind of the last straw for a lot of grain farmers. You know, they've been pretty grumpy for a while about some of the farm programs. And then the perception and sense that they're not getting they're not getting the attention they should be getting is kind of a last straw. So in some ways that's not surprising. And grain farmers in Ontario tends to be the most aggressive, one of the most aggressive in the country in how it will hit back on government and in the way it conducts its communications. It has done this sort of thing in the past, hiring political consultants to help form their marketing. This is certainly the most aggressive one that I've seen.
And so does the Green Farmers of Ontario continue to stand by the points it's making in this ad?
They certainly are so far. I talked to Marcus Hurl, the Grain Farmers Board Chair, and he said, you know, farmers have been the friendly people who wave by you as they drive by you in the countryside, but, you know, maybe farmers need to be a little more aggressive, a little more edgy. And I put some of the points of the that were a bit dubious in the claims. Yeah, the claims are shortage of food, and he says that there are people who have not been able to get what they need. And then at the end, there's a claim, a pretty ominous claim, that questions where will people get their food when there are no farms. So I asked, you know, are there going to be no farms? Because that's a bit of an excessive claim, I think. And his examples was, you know, farmers are going to have to make some difficult decisions on the farms. They're going to have to, they may have to plant different crops. They may have to skip a fungicide or fertilizer payment. That's all true and all going to be an issue for farmers. But it's not quite the same thing as having no farms. So they are certainly standing by it. And they say that this is part of a long and a campaign in which they're investing quite a bit of money. So this may not be the first controversial ad we'll see out of this campaign, and it will be interesting to follow it, and interesting to see what results they do see from it.
Well, that's great, John. Thanks for filling us in on that.
No problem, Gord. Take care.
That was Farmtario editor John Gregg on a controversial new advocacy advertisement from the Grain Farmers of Ontario. You're listening to Between the Rows, and I'm your host for this episode, Gord Gilmore. A bit later in the show, we'll look at the challenges of the beef packing sector and get a markets update from Phil Franz Workington. But first, a bit more on the support, or lack thereof, for Canadian farmers. As you've just heard, one of the reasons the GFO cited for its dissatisfaction with the government was the relative support Canadian farmers have been getting during the COVID-19 crisis. And they're not alone. Many farmers aren't happy with recent federal announcements. Ed White of the Western Producer recently spoke to Agriculture and Agri-Food Minister Marie-Claude Bibeau for her response to concerns that Canadian aid doesn't go far enough. Here's what she said.
Well, we cannot really compare with another country when we compare only one type of program. In the United States, they don't have the business risk management programs. And we have to remember that when we talk about the business risk management program, it's $1.6 billion, you know, an average year. But this year, it could be double, because these programs are meant to respond to the demand. And there are four major ones responding to different type of needs. And it's important to use them first. And this is why I'm putting... And changing, improving agri-stability, this is still something that we are committed to, but we have to find a path with the provinces to do that. And there is money available through agri-stability, and we have made some administrative, well, a bit of financial too, but changes. So we have postponed the application date to July 3rd. They can have, depending on the provinces, up to 75% in advance payment, and this could be done within a month or so. And since, you know, so many are saying the program does not work, we thought of putting an online calculator estimator online, so they can see by themselves if it's true or not. Because you might have heard the Prime Minister of Alberta saying that the pork producers can get up to $20 a head for their, you know, to compensate for the loss of revenues. And this is what they have been asking for. And I've spoken to a pork producer who told me that for him, it was $11 a head. So it's still worth it. And the other thing is that there's $2.3 billion or so in the AgriInvest account. And this account, I mean, if they are in need of, you know, money, they should access their AgriInvest account. This money is 50% of this money. It comes from the government, and it has been put there to help them during difficult years. So, you know, if they are not accessing the programs that are available to them, it's harder for me to get more. So this is why we are willing to put more to support them differently. more significantly, but I need them to use the program to see where the gaps are and who are those who are in greatest need, so we can put in place the right additional programs to support them.
That was Canada's Minister of Agriculture and Agri-Food, Marie-Claude Bibeau, talking to the Western Producers' Ed White. This is Between the Rows, the podcast of Glacier Farm Media, and I'm your host this week, Gord Gilmore. A bit later in the show, we'll talk to the Western Producers' Robert Arneson about how one well-placed cattle insider says the large processing plants are going to continue to be the future of the sector, despite their current challenges. Phil Franz Workington of Markets Farm will also bring us a commodities update. But first, here's Alexis Stockford of the Manitoba Cooperator. That province's beef sector has long wished for more local slaughter capacity, including a well-publicized effort to attract a plant during the BSE era. Yet despite that, all the wishing has come to naught. Alexis joins us now to tell us why. Alexis, thanks for being here today.
Hey, Gord. Great to be here.
So what's the conversation around these days around beef packing in Manitoba?
I mean, I don't think it's going to be news to anybody that there's a certain amount of frustration, particularly from the feeders and backgrounders that we do have in the province, because they're looking at some very dire market situations right now. And you know, anytime that we see a market downturn like this, where it's very processing oriented, you see this conversation about processing capacity in the province, and you know, why isn't there more processing capacity in the province? And you know, you do see frustration from farmers because they're seeing the, you know, the beef price in the supermarket versus what they're getting at the auction mart or what they're getting out of their feedlot, and there's frustration. They're maybe feeling like they're tired of being the bottom rung in that supply chain ladder.
We've heard this conversation before. I'm thinking in particular around the time of the BSE crisis. You know, the market realities there saw a lot of interest in new packing capacity too. But in the end, very little seemed to change. Why is that?
I mean, I think you're right. And when I talk to the experts, when I talk to the people who were public officials at the time surrounding BSE, they draw... You know, they're also kind of drawing the parallels between the market situation now and the market situation then, which was, you know, you have these processors. There's this supply bottleneck at the processing level, and you're right. There was a lot of frustration at that point too. And what came out of that was that there seemed to be a push to see if we could get more processing capacity in Manitoba. You know, in 2004, the province released a feasibility study around this. There was, there was a checkoff to see if we could develop more federal beef processing capacity. And, there were a lot of projects that started off and then eventually just trickled out by the wayside. And when you ask the officials and when you ask the industry experts why that happened, there's a couple of things. One of them, you often hear that there's sort of a chicken and egg issue when it comes to Manitoba, in that we don't have a whole lot of feeder capacity. We don't have a lot of feeder or backgrounder operations in the province. We are very cow-calf oriented. And so then there's a sort of a chicken and egg thing where, you know, do you bolster the feeder operations, try to get more feeding capacity, and then hope that the packing and the processing capacity will follow? Or do you put your eggs in the basket of pushing more processing capacity and hope that there will be more feeders that emerge as a result? And so that has sort of been a often cited reason why there's not a lot of processing capacity and why that's a big obstacle. And the other thing just being regulatory issues. Because one of the projects that did get off the ground following BSE was, of course, True North Foods, which is our only federally inspected beef packing plant right now. And if you talk to Calvin Boggs, who is the owner and president and operator of that, he'll be the first to tell you that there was an enormous amount of red tape and that it was very problematic to try and get that certification. So that's certainly an obstacle as well.
And what did your sources have to say when asked about kind of the reality and the possibility of recapturing some of this capacity here in the province? Were they positive about it? Negative, neutral? Where did they kind of come down on it?
They kind of came down on they recognized the opportunity, but they were kind of jaded about the whether that's actually going to come out to anything. And some of them, of course, remembering the years after BSC, when there was this process, this push for more processing capacity, and they saw all of these projects kind of spring up and then they eventually fade to the wayside, and they're kind of drawing parallels to what we're seeing now. At the same time, they do acknowledge that, you know, there is opportunity if people look for it. And, you know, I asked the question, is there a possibility of sort of a grassroots movement? Is there a possibility of you know, the feeders kind of banding together and or the producers banding together and getting something off the ground from a grassroots level? And the answer is, yeah, you know, that's an opportunity, but at the same time, beef producers are independent operators, and they're used to making independent decisions on how they operate their farms, and you know, there might be some obstacles in getting the amount of cooperation that would be required for that to become a thing.
And there were, in fact, these some past attempts to do exactly that. What were the stumbling blocks for those?
Just sort of the stumbling blocks that we've already mentioned, which is, you know, first of all, that you need to have a steady supply of market-ready cattle, which is difficult if you don't have a very robust amount of feeders and backgrounders in the province. That being said, if you talk to the feeders and the backgrounders, though, you know, there seems to be consensus that there is demand and that there is that there might be enough demand to support more federal capacity. And then the other obstacle is on the other end of the plant, so to speak, which is, you know, do you have the markets for this? Do you have them established? And not just markets for the prime cuts, but do you have your markets established for the less desirable parts of the animal? And that's, of course, a part of this conversation as well. And so, like, a lot of the challenges for that sort of that grassroots movement are the exact same reasons why you know, you saw these projects trickle off to the side of the road, so to speak.
And what about now? Is there any effort to bring a new packer in now in light of the COVID situation?
I mean, I think it's a little early days at this point because, you know, if you, like, I know that, you know, COVID-19 is something that's permeated the airwaves and permeated media, and it seems like it's been going on forever. But in reality, this is only a thing that's been around for a couple of months. And so, you know, to get any sort of grasp, to get any sort of legitimate project off the ground, I mean, it's the timeline for that's a little short term at this point. Is there conversation among the industry right now? I don't know that there's been a cooperative effort, or if there's been talks to get any sort of cooperative effort involved. Not that I've heard, anyway.
Well, great. Thanks for filling us in on this, Alexis.
Thanks, Gord. It's always great to be here.
That was Alexis Stockford of the Manitoba Cooperator on the challenges of bringing beef processing capacity back to Manitoba. You're listening to Between the Rows, the podcast of Glacier Farm Media. I'm your host this week, Gord Gilmore. Further to the topic of beef processing, the Western producer's Robert Arneson recently had a chance to talk to Martin Unruh on this topic. Unruh is a McGregor, Manitoba area cattle producer and former head of the Canadian Cattlemen's Association. He told Robert that once he did feel more and smaller plants would be a better option, but over time, this opinion has evolved. He now says the modern, large-scale plants are better for farmers, too. Robert, thanks for joining us today.
So, Martin Unruh once thought that more plants would be better, but he seems to have changed his tune on this now. Did he tell you a little bit about how his views evolved?
Yeah, so basically Martin, as you probably know a bit about his backstory, he was kind of came into a leadership role in the cattle sector in the 2000s, sort of post BSD, and he got involved with the Manitoba Cattle Producer Association, and then eventually became vice president, president of the Canadian Cattlemen in the kind of the early 2010s, I think around 2012. And so what he told me is that, you know, when he first sort of got involved in the industry, he sort of assumed that really it would be better for cattle producers if there was like a, I guess, sort of a scattering of smaller packing plants across the prairies, you know, maybe 10 or 12. And obviously that would be helpful to producers because they would be, you know, closer to their buyers sort of thing. It would be easier for transport of animals and so forth. But then when he, I guess, got with the CCA and was traveling with them to various spots in the world, whether it be, you know, Asia or Australia or Europe and across the U.S., you know, he started talking to other folks there and learning about the packing industry elsewhere. And I guess he came to the realization that Canada, because of those two large plants in Alberta, actually does have an advantage because, as he pointed out, the cost of killing, you know, one animal at one of the plants in Alberta is much, much less than, say, a plant in Europe or Australia or elsewhere. And really, it allows us to compete on the world scale and export our beef, you know, at a cheaper price. And, you know, as he said to me, that at the end of the day, like a lot of things, it comes down to price, right? It gives you an advantage if you're trying to sell your beef into a place like Japan or China or wherever. And that benefits Canadian beef producers at the end of the day if we can, you know, be competitive in the global marketplace, right? So
to him, then, the key advantage is one of efficiency. Is that correct?
Yeah. So kind of the way he put it is that, you know, a plant, let's say a small plant that processes, I don't know, 500 head per day someplace in Saskatchewan or Manitoba, just the simple economy, the scale, they just can't compete with like a 4,000 head per day plant in terms of their efficiency. But one thing I didn't include in the story that, you know, he mentioned to me is that it also, those large plants also allow you to take advantage and use the entire carcass. So he gave the example of beef tongues. So I don't eat or consume beef tongues, but in some parts of the world, they're sort of something that's commonly, you know, prepared and eaten by families in restaurants. And he gave the example of Japan. So if you have, say, this large 4,000 head per day plant in Alberta, you can produce a sizable amount of beef tongues per day, you know, and then box them up, ship them off to Japan, and that allows you to get into that market, provide your customers there with enough volume to satisfy their needs, whereas, say, a smaller plant that's like, I don't know, let's say 300 head per day in Manitoba, they just wouldn't have the same volume or amount of beef tongues that they could ship to a place like Japan, and therefore you can't tap into that market. And the way Martin put it to me is, you know, just by selling that extra little bit of, you know, the animal, that increases, you know, your sales value or the value of the carcass, which in turn provides more value to the average producer out there because, you know, the marketer or the company exporting is able to actually capture that opportunity, right? So
now, as we've seen these plants close throughout North America, though, I would say that there have been some disadvantages and some weaknesses that have been revealed. Did he comment at all about whether or not some of those issues can be mitigated so that this model works better?
Yeah, I mean, we talked about that a little bit. Is that he told me that during his time at the CCA, you know, he spoke to Cargill a number of times. It kind of pitched them the idea of saying, hey, like, what about having, you know, a mid-sized packing plant, say in Saskatchewan, maybe in Moose Jaw, that processes perhaps 1,500 head of cattle per day. And that would, you know, obviously provide an opportunity for Manitoba ranchers, cow-calf producers to maybe finish more of the animals and then ship those animals off to Moose Jaw. And so that is sort of like obviously lacking because all the two big packing plants are concentrated in Alberta, and therefore that creates, you know, or increases the transportation costs for producers on the eastern prairies. And then I guess the other big risk here is that because you have just these two plants that kind of dominate the landscape and dominate the marketplace, if by some chance they were ever to close, you know, and because of perhaps the company said, well, we don't want to, you know, invest hundreds of millions to, you know, refurnish or upgrade these plants, and then all of a sudden you have a massive hole in the marketplace where you remove this one facility that handles, you know, whatever 30, 35% or 40% of Canada's processing capacity. And so that obviously is a massive risk. And Martin did talk about that, and that's something that he does think about. And he does worry that, you know, what happens if the companies don't, or the companies being JBS and Cargill don't somehow or decide not to invest in these plants or build a new facility. Okay, well, then what happens? You know, what does that all mean for cattle producers like him? So that obviously is a big risk of concentration. What the answer is, you know, he didn't really provide an answer, but for him, it's still, he's not convinced that small plants are the solution.
In more than one occasion, I think of one particularly here in Manitoba a few years ago, it's been sort of pitched as something that government should get involved in. Now, is that something that that Martin talked to you about at all? What were his feelings on that? Should it be left to the private sector? Is there a role for government?
Yeah, he had pretty strong opinions about this. He didn't hold back at all. I guess that's a nice thing about being a former president of a national organization, is that you kind of speak your mind a bit more freely. And, you know, what he said was, you know, that government and public money getting involved is really just a massive mistake. And I remember doing a lot of stories about, you know, here in Manitoba, about this proposed Keystone Processors plant in Winnipeg, which was supposed to be, I think, about maybe 400 head per day plant. And it was going to be partly funded by cattle producers, partly funded by the provincial government, some money from the feds, and it was never really clear to me who the private investor was in this project. It never, I don't actually recall getting the name of who the people were behind the private funds. But Martin kind of said, you know, based on his experience, is that when government money gets involved, you know, it's a mistake for the public sector to try to compete in the private world. It never works out that well. And I mean, there's many other cases in, you know, the last 10, 15 years or 20 years post-BAC where, you know, a cooperative tried to start some sort of project in Western Canada, sometimes with government money. You know, it didn't really work out all that well. And I guess, you know, for me, I have to ask the question, like, okay, well, if the public is getting involved, okay, well why? Like, why are we committing tax dollars or public money to this cause if there was a need for a small 400-head packing plant and there was demand for that product? You would think that a private investor would seize upon that opportunity. But, you know, there's not really much evidence of that happening as far as I can tell.
Hmm. Well, that's great. Thank you for filling us in on this, Robert.
No problem. Glad to talk to you, Gord.
That was Robert Arneson of The Western Producer, filling us in on how one highly placed cattle industry insider says smaller beef plants aren't the future. You're listening to Between the Rows, the podcast of Glacier Farm Media. I'm your host this week, Gord Gilmore. Now, last but not least, we've got Markets Farm's Phil Franz Workington making sense of the markets for us. Thanks for joining us today, Phil.
Thanks for having me.
So what can you tell us about what's going on with the spring seeding, or should it be, I say, harvesting season that's going on here and in the U.S.?
Yeah, there's still some harvesting going on both here and in North Dakota. The weather has improved a bit in the eastern prairies, and that's helped people make some progress the past few days. over the long weekend. Still some fields, according to anecdotal reports, at least still some fields coming off. There was a week or so ago snow in parts of Saskatchewan and Manitoba, and Alberta is getting a bit of moisture now. It's causing some delays, but at the same time, many areas that the harvest is done, reports on the quality are varying, but generally what I'm hearing is that it turned out a bit better than expected, at least in some cases, some write-offs as well at the same time, but the jury's still out on what the actual quality and all that. At the same time, seeding is underway. Everything in the prairies, at least, is a bit behind normal so far, but guys are plugging away where the weather cooperates. It's Manitoba and Saskatchewan should make good progress over the next week if the forecast hold. Alberta's a bit wetter, but hopefully that doesn't last too long and they're able to get going as well.
Yeah, I'm always amazed at how much ground they can make up if they get a decent run of weather. It seems like they can seed the entire prairies in 2 weeks now.
Yeah, the technology they have is something else, all right.
So, moving into the realm of markets, when we were speaking earlier a little bit before doing this, you had referred to the gift that keeps on giving for the markets commentator, the U.S. and China. What's going on there?
What's going on? I haven't looked at the Twitter yet in the last hour, but just when you think they're back together and a deal's been made and things are good, it all changes. So the last week there had been some optimism. China was buying more U.S. soybeans and life was good for U.S. farmers selling soybeans, and then that all went out the window again. The U.S. and China are at each other again over World Health Organization and COVID-19, and they're kind of laying blame at each other, and what that means for trade remains to be seen. At the same time, you got Brazil in the mix. They've got crops to sell, and they're selling them for cheaper than the U.S., so China, has a deal with the U.S., but why not buy cheaper soybeans from Brazil if it's easier and less hassle? So there's it's the gift that keeps on giving, in that it's one day to the next. There's always something. It drives the market up or down or whatever. You don't know what's going to happen one day to the next. So it's a mystery where that will sort out, but it keeps going.
That it is. And what about wheat? I understand that there's a lot of wheat in the world these days. What's going on in that market?
Yeah, there is a lot of wheat. I guess last week the USDA came out with their estimates on world production and everything, and they're predicting nearly a billion tons of wheat grown in the world, 982 million. That'd be up 23 million on the year. They're predicting record large ending stocks of wheat. So there'll be a lot of wheat around, maybe not always in the right place at the right time. Ukraine and the EU, they're both expected to have smaller crops on the year. They're usually large players on the global export market. So there's big crops out there, but maybe not necessarily in the players that are exporting. So what that means for prices might remain to be seen. From what I've read, China is sitting on maybe half of the world's ending stocks on wheat. So the numbers out of there are sometimes questionable as well. So see what that means. But yeah, big wheat supplies. So that's kind of a bearish anchor on wheat prices. But in the meantime, it's weather markets in North America are kind of driving things. The spring wheat in the northern U.S. is being seeded now, but they're behind normal on their seeding, so that could give a little bit of a underpinning, and quality ratings on the winter wheat in the U.S. have dipped a bit lately, but still relatively decent. So, provided the weather cooperates the next while, see what happens there. But the U.S. also grew a smaller crop, so there's a big world supplies, but kind of smaller, more localized issues that will drive things as well.
Well, thanks for filling us in on all that, Phil.
Thanks for having me.
That was Phil Franz Workington of Markets Farm with the latest on commodities. That's another edition of Between the Rows from Glacier Farm Media. I'm your host this week, Gord Gilmore, saying so long for now. We'll hope you join us again next time. In the meantime, stay safe during this busy season on the farm.
Between the Rows is a production of Glacier Farm Media, Canada's leading farm publisher. We'd love to hear what you think of the show and invite you to send your comments to btr@farmmedia.com or visit us at membersgetmore.ca and sign up today.